One more time, I ask you to turn in your Bible to Exodus chapter 20, and we'll look together one more time at the liberty of living for God that we have been looking at for these weeks in which we've considered the Ten Commandments. We are at commandment number 10 this morning. It's Exodus chapter 20, verse 17, and this is what it says. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. This is the law of God given to us through Moses. And if it had been given to us through someone more contemporary, it might have referred not to our neighbor's servants, male and female, but to our neighbor's household appliances. It might not have referred to his ox or his donkey, but rather his car and his truck and anything that is our neighbor's. We are forbidden from coveting. So I have four notes for you this morning and then three actions. Let's begin. Note number one is really a matter of defining the word coveting. Here it is. The 10th commandment prohibits strong desires for anything that is your neighbor's. The definition of coveting being a strong desire for something. We are forbidden to strongly desire anything that belongs to our neighbors. So notice this about this commandment. In a way, it's in a category of its own. The 10th commandment takes the laws of the land to a whole new level. And probably we ought not think of it as a whole new level higher, but rather a whole new level lower or a whole new level inward. This commandment takes the law of God the next level in and addresses matters of the inner life. It's just what we should expect God to do in his law. For Jesus, being God, summarized the Ten Commandments with one commandment, which was to love God, the Lord your God, with all your heart and soul and mind and strength. That's the first summary of the Ten Commandments. And you'll notice that at least three of those four qualifiers has to do with attitude, has to do with your inner life, the heart, the soul, the mind. And for that matter, there's nothing to stop us from thinking that the strength is a reference to the inner life as well. This raises questions. In fact, a couple of questions that we should keep in mind as we work our way through the notes. And the first question that comes to mind from this idea that God is forbidding a certain attitude is the question of how he can do it. I mean, how can we be expected to obey him when he forbids a certain attitude? How can he expect us in obedience to him to stop feeling the way we feel, which is what he is calling us to do when he says we should not covet? How can an attitude be forbidden or commanded, for that matter? The answer is coming, but not just now. We'll go on to the second question that we should keep in mind as we work our way through the notes here as well, and that is that of all the sins of the inner life, of all the attitudes that God might forbid, why does he forbid this one in particular? Why coveting, identified as the one attitude which he mentions in the Ten Commandments, is absolutely forbidden? I mean, it's a worthwhile question to ask in order to seek to understand. We could wonder, why didn't he forbid some other attitude as well, or some other attitude instead? Why did he not prohibit cruelty? Why did he not ban fear? Why did he not rule out flippancy? Why did he not speak against selfishness? I mean, all these are bad attitudes, as craving or coveting is a bad attitude, but coveting is the only ones mentioned. And the answer to that second question is the second note. So here it is, note number two. Coveting is the root of all evil. I would say it's forbidden specifically because from it comes all the evil that we're capable of committing. Coveting is the root of all evil. Someone will say, but wait a minute, isn't that what money is? Doesn't the Bible say money is the root of all evil? And someone else should say, no, the Bible does not say money is the root of all evil. It says the love of money is the root of all evil. And besides that, the word all can always be translated all kinds of evil rather than all evil, period. So that's what the Bible says. Let me just show you that. It's relevant to our study this morning. 1 Timothy chapter 6 is where Paul says what he says. It's in verse 10. He says, for the love of money is a root of all kinds of evils. It's through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. There the word craving helps us to understand that what God is forbidding in the Ten Commandments is pretty much what Paul is talking about when he speaks of the love of money. Craving is a coveting. By definition, that's what the word means. You shall not crave things is what thou shalt not covet means. And Paul the Apostle identifies the love of money as the root of all kinds of evil, as a craving which some have wandered away from the faith because of, and some have been pierced with many pangs because of. But what is the love of money? Except the desire to have what you need to get everything that you want, everything that you crave. There's more than one way of saying the same thing. So you can talk about coveting, or you can talk about the love of money, or you can talk the way Jesus did in the Sermon on the Mount on the same topic, when he said, we have it in Matthew chapter 6, when Jesus said, no one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. He summarizes, you cannot serve God and money. Which is to say that the ultimate root of all sin, the cause of all of our disastrous disobediences, comes from having something to worship, something that we think is ultimately worthwhile other than God himself, and to make, therefore, a God of something other than the God that we are called to worship. Whatever we're living for, that is, whatever we're strongly desiring as if it is the goal of our lives, becomes, in some sense, a God that we worship. And that thought prompts the third note. Look at us flying through these notes. We're already at number three. Note number three. Coveting is idol worship. And this we get from the Apostle Paul, but we've already got it as we think about loving either God or something else, serving either God or money. But Paul says it's idolatry in his letter to the Colossians. It's chapter 3. He also says this in Ephesians 5, by the way, but we've already looked in this series at Colossians 3, so we'll stick with what's familiar to us. He says that we need a very harsh attitude against certain attitudes and the actions that come from them. It's Colossians chapter 3, verse 5. He says, put to death, therefore, what's earthly in you. And name some examples. He speaks of sexual immorality. He says, kill that. He speaks of impurity. He says, put that to death. He speaks of passion and evil desire in the same way. And then he mentions covetousness. And he says we should put it to death. And he gives a reason. He says it's idolatry, which tells us that when our hearts are caught up with some craving, when there's something that we desire a lot, something, for example, that belongs to someone else, we've made an idol of that thing. It's idol worship. It's having some other god to worship rather than God. And that brings us to the fourth note, but I want to skip it for now, and I promise to come back to it. But in the view of the first three notes, I want to move to the actions. And here's action A, coming out of the forbidding of coveting. Action A, be content for now with what you have. The ban on coveting is a call to contentment. But I'd like to make sure you notice that I'm saying that the call is to be content for now with what you have. Because in actual fact, there's a lot of room in biblical living for improvement. And in fact, you could see that in a lot of the commandments of God, a lot of the Ten Commandments have been given specifically by God that we might improve our lives by ridding our lives of the danger. So Christianity is not at all taking a stand against being restless in what you've got, not content with what you've got, and determined to improve your circumstances. But the ban on coveting calls us to be content for now with what we have. This is one of the ways in which Christianity is decidedly different from Buddhism, if you're interested in comparative religions. For Buddhism teaches that the only way to be perfectly at peace is to so effectively suppress all your wants and desires that you no longer want or desire anything. And that's not Christianity at all. The Ten Commandments, and before that we saw it in the series called Exiting Egypt, is all about getting from where we are living as slaves to various wicked slave masters into the life of the promised land, into the life flowing with milk and honey God means for us to work hard to improve our circumstances. We saw that in the Exiting Egypt series. We saw that in the Liberty for Life series, which is our study of the Ten Commandments. And we will see it starting next week in a new three-week series called Time to Sow. God gives us the opportunity to improve our circumstances. We ought not to be negligent of the opportunities to improve. But meanwhile, we're called to be content for now with what we have. And that leads to the third question that sort of bubbles up from this study, a very practical question about contentment. This is the question. Really, how is contentment actually possible? I mean, we're talking about each of us being content with all of our circumstances for now and not being caught up with a craving for what someone else has. I don't want to be really blunt and down to earth about this so that you take this into your own life and your own frame of reference. So let's think about how challenging contentment is sometimes, even when we qualify by saying content for now. Let's think about a man married to a really excellent wife. Hypothetically speaking, here's a man whose wife is really, really smart. And not just that, but she's really, really kind-hearted. Besides that, she's really good-looking, if you can imagine. Imagine that that man has a friend, and there's a striking contrast between his friend's wife and his own wife. His friend's wife, not so smart, not the sharpest hook in the tackle box, and not really very sweet at all, kind of a crabby lady. And as far as attractive goes, that was then, this is now, the poor dear's let herself go. So here are these two guys, and they're good friends. They get together socially, sometimes with their wives. And can we really expect the guy with the obviously less appealing wife to not notice that he's married to a less appealing woman, and his friend is married to the kind of woman that any man would be glad to be married to? Are we really expecting him to contrast and compare and say, my wife is nothing like his wife, and I'm fine with that? That's what contentment would be. Considering, again, the fact that, you know, we're invited to work improvements in our lives, and there's ways in which we can help every marriage improve. So it's not that you are condemned to contentment for your whole life, but realistically, you're commanded to contentment for right now. And that's just one illustration. Now, let me do the other side of the coin for the sake of balance. Let's picture a woman, a sister with an older sister and a younger sister. And this middle sister is married to a man who is not a very good husband. He is, let's say, lazy and unambitious. Doesn't seem to have any intention of doing anything except lying on the couch watching TV. And he is a crabby man and kind of rude in his speech and a very self-centered person. And truth be told, the middle sister is not very happy in her marriage. And she has an older sister and a younger sister. The younger sister is single, just talking hypothetically, and the older sister is married to a great guy who is entrepreneurial and creative and always coming up with new ways to provide for the family through stunning sort of business propositions that actually make the world a better place. And though he works very, very hard, he balances his work with his family life so he does not neglect his wife or his kids, but is often home with them. Through creative planning, he's able to devote himself to his family so that his family does not suffer from his business success. But his business is a success, and he's a wealthy man and a generous provider. That's the older sister's life. So you can imagine that the younger sister looks at her slightly older sister and her older sister and really wishes she could find a guy like her older sister found. And secretly is pretty glad that she never found a guy like her middle sister found. And what's the middle sister supposed to think? Her husband is obviously less appealing a man to be married to. And is she really supposed to welcome the fact that she's married to him when her sister is married to him? This is what's forbidden. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or husband or anything that belongs to your neighbor. And the gnarly question is, how is that attitude even possible? I mean, there's no merit in just pretending obedience. This is a commandment that strikes to the heart. It's the heart that is being commanded here. You shall not covet anything that belongs to your neighbor. How is that even possible? And the answer to that practical question is intriguing. Here's the answer. How is contentment possible? It's a secret. That's the answer. Paul the Apostle calls it a secret, but good news, the secrets in the Bible are all revealed. The word mystery in English comes from the Greek word mysterium, which means a secret, but always means a revealed secret. And this secret is revealed. But it's called a secret. Paul calls it that in Philippians chapter 4. He's writing a very warm-hearted letter to some Christians who were living in very troubled times in Philippi, had lots to complain about, but the letter calls them to joy and speaks of Paul's own joy. One of the things he was joyful about was the fact that the Philippians had once again found it possible to be generous towards him in regard to his ministry. And he's happy with the gift and what it represents, but he doesn't want them to think wrongly of his happiness. So here's what he says in Philippians chapter 4. He says, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at length you revived your concern for me. You were indeed concerned for me, but you had no opportunity. And then, not to be misunderstood, he says, not that I'm speaking of being in need, for I have learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. He has learned to be content. He has learned how to be brought low. He's learned how to abound. He goes on to say, in any and every circumstance, I've learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, the secret of facing abundance and need. Isn't that interesting that he considers the secret equally applicable to days of plenty as to days of hunger? To conditions of abundance as well as conditions of need, he has got a secret by which he is able to be content in all his circumstances. Notice that it requires something secret to be content in abundance, to be content in days of plenty. And we who don't consider ourselves to have plentiful or abundant circumstances didn't know that the people who do have plentiful and abundant circumstances also have their challenges. It's true, Paul knew it from experience, and he'd learned the secret of being content in all circumstances. Now, it's interesting to note that it's in this context that we get to a very famous Bible verse. It's in this context that Paul says, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. And the context is really intriguing. He's saying, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I can be content when I don't have the things that I feel I need and want. And I can be content when I have more of the things I want than I even can use. Interesting. That's what he's talking about when he says, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. And it's also in this context that verse 19 gets to this familiar statement, and my God will supply every need of yours according to his riches and glory in Christ Jesus. That verse obviously has application to us trusting God to provide us with what we need. But in the context, what he's looking for God to provide him with is the means to be content, whether he has what he needs or doesn't have what he needs. Either way, he can be content. And he refers to it as the secret, which brings us to action B, which is to learn the secret of being content. And if you're taking notes, you might just want to put a little caret after the word learn and say, and then practice. Because learning the secret of being content will only do you a little bit of good if you don't, having learned it, begin to practice it. Learn and then practice the secret of being content. And now it's time to go back to the fourth note, which I saved until now. Note four. The secret of being content with what you presently have, in one word, is godliness, which might surprise you. But maybe the word surprises you as the secret because of what you think godliness means. Godliness seems to many of us to be a sort of fuzzy word, meaning all-round religious goodness. But that's not exactly what it means at all. In fact, it has a much more specific meaning to that. So I've left you a line below the line if you're taking notes, and you can add to the word godliness what it really means in terms of its New Testament usage. It really means God-wordness, God-wordness. It means being devoted to God. There's room on the line to say that too. The secret of being content with what you presently have is godliness or God-wordness or devoted to God-ness. Godliness means that your focus is solidly on God. And that, according to the Apostle Paul, is the secret of truly being content with your unsatisfactory present conditions. Content for now. This secret shows how you can be genuinely, truly content that things aren't so great in your personal life. The idea that contentment and godliness belong together comes from the Apostle Paul. 1 Timothy chapter 6, where we saw what he says in verse 10 about the love of money, we see the build-up to that statement in verses 6 to 9. Here's what Paul said to Timothy. He says, now there's great gain in godliness with contentment. You could almost translate that with hyphens between the words godliness and with and contentment. Godliness with contentment is a certain sort of godliness. That is, it's biblical godliness. It's a sort of godliness that brings with it contentment. And he has this to say about being so Godward that you are content. He says, we brought nothing into the world, which is to say, we were born naked and penniless. And we cannot take anything out of the world. We will die into the same condition. He says, but if we have food and clothing, food and raiment is the old translation. The word translated raiment or clothing, it can also be translated covering. It might mean what you cover your body with. It might mean what you cover your family with. It can mean food and a roof or food and clothes. Having that, with these, we will be content, which is to say that as long as you got enough to avoid starving to death and enough to avoid freezing to death or dying of sun poisoning, you should be okay with your circumstances. In contrast to those, he says, but those who desire to be rich, they fall into temptation and into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. It's at that point that he says, for the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. So he's calling Timothy to call the people that Timothy is leading at his church in Ephesus to stay away from the ruin and the destruction and the senseless and harmful desires that come to anybody who is consumed with the love of money, who is full of coveting, and instead strive for the godliness which brings with it contentment. So I want us to think about the secret in regard to how a focus on God actually prepares us, arms us, fuels us to be truly and genuinely okay with the fact that things in our lives are not okay. And this will be a brilliant thing if we figure it out, because it will give us the opportunity to show joy and peace while going through hard times, not to be downtrodden or depressed or sulky about the fact that we don't have it as good as some other people, but actually to be good with it, actually to rejoice that things aren't great in our lives. That's the secret. I want to show you three mentions of the secret from different perspectives, all the same thing being said in different ways. We can see it in something Jesus said. In John chapter 4, it's recorded the story of the woman at the well. And you know that story starts with Jesus staying by a well while the disciples went into town to get some food. They come back with the food and they see that he's not very interested in the food. He explains it in verse 34. Jesus said to them, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. That's a Godward attitude. Not that he didn't believe in eating. He lived into his 30s, so he obviously often ate. But on the other hand, he could set aside his normal, natural interest in food for a long period of time because he was feeding on a different sort of food. His food was the satisfaction that came from doing what God had sent him to do. That's a Godward focus. That's the secret. We see the secret spoken of differently in Psalm 73, something that Asaph wrote. He's one of the people who wrote the Psalms, and Psalm 73 is all about dealing with the envy that comes from seeing that wicked people are getting ahead in life while godly people aren't doing so well. When that seems to be your situation, when you find yourself having a hard time wondering why God doesn't punish the evildoers but allows them to prosper while his own people don't seem to be well looked after, you should remember two numbers, 3 and 7. And with those two numbers remembered, go to Psalm 37 and Psalm 73. They're both on the same great theme of being Godward in regard to your inclinations towards envy and jealousy. And in the second of the two, Psalm 73, verse 25 says, Asaph says, whom have I in heaven but you? He's talking to God, of course. Whom have I in heaven but you? And there's nothing on earth that I desire besides you. He says, there in heaven is God. I have God in heaven. And I have God in earth. I have God in my life on earth. And as long as I have God, Asaph says, there's nothing else I desire, which I think is to be understood as all the other desires I have, the normal and natural and healthy desires, and all of the intentions I have to improve my life are like no desire at all compared to my desire for God. This is godliness. This is Godwardness. It's the secret that brings with it this supernatural kind of contentment. And if you want to see the secret mentioned in some other place, I could take you all the way back to Exodus 20, which would be appropriate because that's where we are this morning. And looking at what God said at the very beginning of the Ten Commandments. We saw this weeks ago now. Here's how the Ten Commandments start. God spoke all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. That's the first commandment. And here you see the Ten Commandments doing a sort of interesting thing. Because the Tenth Commandment, which bans coveting, commands contentment. And the secret to contentment is to be a person who has no other God besides God. So the Tenth Commandment requires obedience to the First Commandment, and so the commandments sort of bend back on themselves and form something of a circle. The ban against coveting commands us to obey the First Commandment, and I think you've seen how all the other commandments come out of that one. So it's time for us now, as we've connected the Tenth Commandment to the First Commandment, to do some summarizing. So I want you to think about how this series on the Ten Commandments that I've called Liberty for Life connects itself pretty naturally to the series that preceded it from Exodus 1 to 19 called Exit in Egypt. I mean, it was supposed to. It's a sequel, and it's Exodus chapter 20. It's what happens next in the Bible. But we saw in the series Exit in Egypt how God, meaning for his people to improve their circumstances, went through all kinds of miraculous deeds through Moses principally, in order to convince the people that they could trust God to follow Moses across the wilderness and into a land where a much superior life would be lived, a land flowing with milk and honey. And we saw how the exit from Egypt and the entrance into the promised land was an allegory for God's intention to free us from the inferior sort of lives we live when we don't obey God and have other gods before him, moving into the promised land where we are truly at liberty. Liberty to be what God calls us to be, liberty from the things that prevent us from being what God calls us to be. And we saw how on the way to the land flowing with milk and honey, on the way to the promised land, they stopped off by God's leading through Moses at Mount Sinai. And Moses disappeared for 40 days and came back down off the mountain with the Ten Commandments, which are the laws of liberty in the land. God, in his kindness towards his people, commanding them to be done with certain attitudes and actions which will rob them of the liberty that he has exerted his power to give them, to bring them to. And what we ought to see here in terms of contentment, in terms of Godwardness, is that all of this obedience comes, and the life that follows it comes from being totally sure of a few things about God. Our attitude towards his law comes out of our attitude towards him. We need to be totally sure of God's greatness, particularly as it pertains to his power. We need to be totally sure that God is a God of great power, a God whose authority is absolute, a God who does have the right to command whatever he wishes to command, whether he's commanding the light to begin, let there be light, or the world to exist and to remain in existence, or whether he's commanding his people to put off murder and stealing and adultery and bearing false witness and coveting. God has the power to command whatever he wills. But it's not just believing in the power of God's, the greatness of God's power that will get us to contentment. It's also being convinced of the greatness of God's love. What he commands because he has the right to command, he commands because he loves his people. He loves us who are his people. And he wants to protect us from harm the way any good parent wants to protect his child from harm. So like a good parent who would tell his child not to play in traffic and not to take drugs and not to take rides from strangers, God commands us to stay away from things that will hurt us out of his love for us. We need to be convinced of the greatness of God's power and the greatness of God's love, but we also need to be convinced of the greatness of God's wisdom. He's not a well-meaning but kind of dumb parent. He's a well-meaning and infinitely wise parent. And what he commands out of an infinite knowledge of the human condition and of your life in particular, as he plans for you a huge improvement from the life you lived as a slave to sin and a slave to various passions and pleasures. And he moves you into a life spent serving him with no other God before you. Being convinced of the greatness of God's power and his love and his wisdom will convince us of something else. It will convince us that God is working all things in our lives for our good, as the Bible promises that he is. And that leads to the conviction, get this, believing that God is working all things out for good in our lives leads us to the conviction that our circumstances right now, what's going on in our lives right now, April 11, 2010, is all part of the details of God's prescription for our Christ-likeness. This is what we're told. All things work together for good, because those whom he foreknew, he predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son. What God has brought into our lives is not our bad luck. It's not luck at all. It's design. And that has to do with the really positive things in your life, which warm our hearts to his kindness and induce us to follow him, as it applies to the harsh realities of our lives and the things that we would not choose for ourselves if we were writing the script, because of God's design for us. And his design, his intention for us, stated positively, is Christ-likeness. And his design or his intention for us, stated negatively, is freedom from sin and all the poison that sin produces and all the contamination that it produces and all the grief and all the bitterness and all the dysfunction. God means to lead us away from all these disastrous things. So he commands us to do and to be a certain sort of person with certain sorts of actions, because he means for us to be like Christ. He means for us to be free from sin. The Bible says that the wages of sin is death. When you serve sin, you get your paycheck at the end of the week. The wages of sin is death. And the further problem is that along with the wage that sin pays, there's also a benefits package, a horrible benefits package. Along with the death, sin gives grief and bitterness and bad relationships and discontent. But God assures us that there's a cure for it all. There's an antidote to it all. And he will free us from our sin, and he gives us his law as a way of doing that, summarized in the commandment to love God with all our heart, soul, and mind, and strength, and our neighbor as ourselves, and then detailed from the very beginning in the Ten Commandments. So we're ready for a summary statement of this study of liberty for life. And the summary statement could be this, that the secret to liberty in the land, the secret to living the life of freedom that Christ came to give us, the secret is learning how to live the life God calls us to live, a life that's free from the greed and the unhappiness and the enslavement to various passions and pleasures that otherwise is the condition in which we live. Even while we're working on making everything better, he offers us contentment for now. And the contentment comes from our conviction that the things that are happening to us, both good and bad, are not happening by accident or happening randomly, but happening according to the purposes of God, who purposes to make us like Christ. And that's enough to produce contentment. It's also enough to motivate us to love God even more, which brings me back to the action list and the third action, action C, by which we come to an answer to the first question that arose, which is the question about commanding attitude or forbidding attitude, which was what the 10th commandment does. So look at action C. It comes out of what we've seen already. Action C is to love the Lord your God with all your heart. And that's God commanding an attitude. He commands us to summon up all our energies and direct them towards the love of God so that we're loving him wholeheartedly, whole soul, with our whole soul, whole mindedly, with all our strength. He's commanding us to love him that way. That's an attitude commanded, which makes another attitude forbidden. The opposite attitude, the attitude of restlessness that says, why do I have to have this when other people have something better? The answer is because God, in his wisdom and his love, commands the details of your life for your good. And we should respond by loving him with our whole heart, which means loving him more than anything else we love, and loving him more than we love ourselves. It means loving what he loves more than anything we would love otherwise, which takes the air out of our desires for other things. It means loving what he wants for us more than what we want for ourselves or would want otherwise. It means loving what he's doing in our lives to bring about the changes by which we will become who he means for us to be. and then looking at the parts of our lives that we're not very happy about and recognizing them as that. If our marriage is not going as well as we want it to go, even though we are doing our part to improve it, or we're not married and we wish we were, or if our job is not panning out, or we're in between jobs, if we've got some very real bad circumstances, godliness, a focus on God, and an understanding of God gives us the power to actually embrace the difficulties. And that's what the New Testament talks about over and over again when it tells us to count it all joy when we experience various trials and to rejoice in our difficulties. Not stupidly, not arbitrarily, but because we recognize that our difficulties are loaded up with the purposes of God, by which means we become content for now with all of the details of life. This, the commandments of God, sets us up to experience. This we should wish for each other, because we mean to be a group of people who collectively and then scattering through the city, independently, individually, help people come to see what a great God is. And here is a brilliant way in which we can shine with the light of God's truth, to not have everything perfect in our lives and to be joyful, that being the case, to be at peace in those circumstances is a brilliant witness, is a brilliant demonstration of the greatness of God. This is the liberty into which God calls us as his people through his goodness to us. We began this series by standing together and reciting the Ten Commandments. I thought it would be appropriate, especially in view of all we've seen about the commandments, all there is to love about God's law, to repeat the experience. So I'll ask you to stand with me now and join me as together we recite with love and worship the commandments that God in his love for us has given us. Let's read them together. Number one, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Number two, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Number three. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Number four, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant or your female servant, or your livestock, or the sojourner who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Number five, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. Number six, you shall not murder. Number seven, you shall not commit adultery. Number eight, you shall not steal. Number nine, you shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And number ten, you shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. This is the law of God. Let us give thanks to him for it. Let us pray. Father, we thank you for loving us so much